eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease and a whole lot of love, you transform 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. LED headlights, spoilers, whatever you need. eBay Motors has it at affordable prices. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Save big money on your next project with help from Menards. Move water where you need it quickly with a Barracuda sump pump. Sump pumps keep your basement dry when big storms hit unexpectedly. Get a half horsepower cast iron Barracuda sump pump on sale now through May 5th. Hurry into Menards. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of I Weigh with Jamila Jamil. I hope that you're well. I am fine. I've just started a new job in the last week or so. I'm shitting myself because I feel very rusty and underprepared and freaked out, and filming during COVID is extremely odd, though I'm so excited and grateful to be back at work. But oh, I feel like a beginner again. I wonder if any of you are going through the same thing now that everyone's getting vaccinated, the world's opening back up. Are any of you facing anxiety about the world opening back up? I've expressed that before during many of my intros, my fear of who I am and how the hell I'm going to cope at something called a party if I ever go to one of those again. Anyway, I'll keep you posted, I guess, as best as I can about how I'm doing on this new job. I think you'll just be able to gauge it from the tension in my voice. But wish me luck. Now, today's episode means a lot to me. It's a conversation I've wanted to have for ages, and I didn't quite know how I was going to go about it. If you have been following me for a while, you might know that I am obsessed with how damaging tabloid media is, in particular to women. I really believe in the system of build women up, specifically to rip them down. And I've had conversations before on this podcast. Just last week, I had Kelly Rowland on the podcast being extraordinary. If you have not heard that episode, please go back and listen to it. She's so amazing. And I feel as though not enough people in the world, even though she's got 10 million followers on Instagram, still that is not enough people in the world knowing what just a gem and an icon this woman is. So go back and listen to that. But she and I touched on, you know, media interference in her career, what it was like dealing with that much misogyny, so many lies. And while it's all good and well and so important to have this conversation with those who are suffering from this dynamic, it's also really important to have this conversation with those who were on the other side with one of the journalists. And I just so happen to know someone who dipped out of tabloid journalism about 8 years ago. He just was fed up. He could see the ugliness and he just didn't want anything more to do with such a horrifying industry. He'd seen so many awful things and just been a part of so many things that he was feeling ashamed of and uncomfortable with. And so long before this Britney documentary came out, long before the Paris Hilton documentary came out, long before Meghan Markle even was a name that many of us knew, this person had left. His name is Dean Piper, and he's a really, really wonderfully open, sincere, accountable, intelligent, and good person. And he came onto this podcast, which I thought was really brave, because not a lot of people who have been in tabloid culture or who are ever want to own up to any of their part in the rampant misogyny that seeps from tabloid media into our society. But Dean just came on with nothing to hide. And we just had a very soothing and healing conversation about all of that, where I got to ask him what it's like, you know, what goes through the mind of someone who's in tabloid culture. How does it work? What is the system of build up and rip down? And he answered a lot of my questions, and I just found it really interesting and an important listen, because it's great to finally meet one of the makers, even though he doesn't do it now. He was someone who did at a very high level for a long time. And so perhaps if you are someone who reads these articles or who clicks on those websites, who clicks on the pictures, who shares them, who shares the memes, don't worry, we're all there with you. I've done it too. It's important to understand the inner workings of what it is that you're buying into, that you're accidentally maybe even funding with your clicks, with your shares, with your algorithms. This episode is not just about tabloid media or celebrity. It's also about public accountability, the things that we can do as members of the public to protect people in the public eye, but mostly women, and mostly just taking into account that, fine, even if you don't give a shit about public figures because they're super privileged and really who cares, I don't mind that. I'm all here for however anyone would feel about not wanting to be protective over the most protected people in the world. I totally get that. But we have to think about the fact that this culture bleeds into schools, it bleeds into offices, it bleeds into workplaces everywhere. And so it is important for us to combat it in order to make sure that we build a safer world for us and future generations. And with everything going on this week, like poor old Khloe Kardashian, who we don't discuss in this episode because we recorded it just before this mess of her posting lots of pictures of herself on holiday, clearly breathing in till her ribs are exposed, and very stylized, posed photographs, quite possibly quite edited. And then someone else posted a picture of her unedited and she looked a bit different. She looked fantastic in the unedited photograph. In my opinion, much better than she does in any edited photograph. She looks like a real person. She looks beautiful. She looks happy. She looks free. She's not closing her eyes and sucking in her stomach till she can't breathe. She just looks free and young and cool. And sadly, she sees that photograph and just sees only flaws. And so she tried to get that photograph taken down off the internet. This perfectly fine photograph. And as soon as you try and do something like that, as soon as you start to take extreme actions to stop the world from finding out about something, that is often when it becomes the most viral, because that's just human nature and people want to do and see what is forbidden. And it's just been a fucking mess. And as much as I have I have made my problems with the Kardashians known over the years, because I hate that they do perpetuate these false edited ideals and beauty standards that they uphold, which frustrate me. I also feel really fucking bad for them. And I've said this all along, that they wouldn't be this obsessed with diet culture, with their appearance. They wouldn't probably promote this much stuff around their aesthetic if they hadn't been so bullied and scrutinized by the media, but also by the public. Anyone who's ever shared any articles fat shaming them, commenting on their looks, even to just complain about the article, but mostly any of us who've ever shared those articles or those memes, who've ever enjoyed the gossip around the Kardashians when people are making fun of the way they look, we've all been part of the problem. We've all perpetuated their perpetuation, is that a word? Of this cycle of fat phobia and self-hate. And so again, it feels like a very timely moment to discuss tabloid media, the public, our obsession with women, our obsession with shitting on women. This is just an episode that I've been hoping for ages, and I'm so lucky that Dean was willing to come on and be vulnerable with me about it. So please enjoy, honestly, one of my favourite chats I've had in a while, with the excellent Dean Piper. Welcome to I Weigh. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm good, really good.
I haven't seen you in years. I have not seen you in bloody years.
I mean, we do go way back, don't we? Like, we used to do the circuit like nobody else.
Yeah. So I started in this business in about probably 2009, early 2009, and I met you at the very beginning of my career. You were a journalist. Mm. I was a young new TV host and, talent and this was a, it was a scary time in the rise of tabloid culture, just as I had entered the industry. And you were one of the only nice journalists that I met in my entire time as a public figure in the UK. And you have had such an incredible ride in and out of celebrity showbiz culture. Yeah. And so given everything that's happened with the recent Britney Spears documentary, the Paris Hilton documentary, and also the new old clips of Lindsay Lohan that have been surfacing of how she's been mistreated by you know, like big mainstream media figures like Letterman, etc. And then also, of course, what we saw earlier this year with Meghan Markle and the way she was hounded by the media and the ongoing way she's been hounded for the last 4 years. I couldn't think of anyone I would rather... Oh, okay, Dean is holding up a Harry and Meghan cup in solidarity.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to someone who'd been on the inside of the machine, someone who could break down tabloid culture, showbiz culture, celebrity culture for us all, so we could understand how we got to this point and what the mentality is behind it. What is the goal and what is the impact of that, not just on the celebrities, but on our society and also on the journalists who have to participate in that themselves. And as someone who left, what, 8 years ago, 7 years ago?
Yeah, I think it was about 8 years ago. I mean, just to start off with, you could not have broken into the industry at a worse time. It's yeah, literally the worst time.
I know.
You know, it was literally the pits. It was like, oh, good. You know, we were at every event and everything was just crumbling around us. And I guess you were just at the point when social media was just starting to erupt.
Yeah, it was 2009 when Twitter started, or when I joined Twitter anyway. And that was I got into trouble internationally on my first tweet.
That doesn't surprise me somehow, actually. I mean, it was carried on.
It was unbelievable. I was being like shamed by Australian tabloids over in over my first ever tweet. It was and it was a careless, shitty tweet that I thought I was being funny and didn't understand. Humor does not translate well over text. However, you left 8 years ago before it was trendy to denounce this industry, and before it was trendy to say it is an unacceptable way to live, to treat people like we are contributing to a sickness in society. And therefore, I didn't want someone to come on here who's only just had that kind of revelation. Now that we're all turning on the tabloids, like, I really wanted you here.
I think that having 8 years to just sit back and look at the industry and look where it is and look at the way that all of the news outlets pretty much still doing what they were doing back then. I mean, maybe in a bit more of a legal way. But if we take it right the way back to when I first started in 2001, that was a completely different celebrity culture. You know, we didn't have social media. We were still coming off the back of the Spice Girls and all of these people that had this amazing freedom in their career of, you know, yeah, sure, they had paparazzi and they had all of that to deal with. But they actually were able to have a bit of anonymity and they were able to
control the narrative a bit.
Yeah, they were, you know, and also from my point of view, you know, me and you, we would go to many an event and I think we went to blooming every party for about 4 years on the trot. But it was fun back then. You know, we were going out with Courtney Love. We were in the same restaurant as Madonna. We were going on tour with Kylie and getting a really good exclusive. We were kind of in this amazing bubble. And it was like going behind a velvet rope. And I feel like within those kind of 6 or 7 years when it kind of got into the noughties and everything started to really get, I don't know, pretty twisted and effed up, we realised that it wasn't a game. You know, there was so many serious implications by the fact that as showbiz journalists, we were basically making a living and reveling in people's misery.
Yeah, it was an odd transition, wasn't it? Because I still remember the kind of the golden era of the, you know, the Cameron Diaz, the Julia Roberts era, where it felt like there was like an element of royalty to them. And should there be that kind of hierarchy in society? Probably not. However, it felt like the media and talent had more of a kind of mutually beneficial relationship, but there was a respect of like, I need you, you need me, let's be nice to each other, let's be real. It's not always going to be perfect and rosy, but let's get along because we're in this shit together. And what I feel like, you know, you told me a story about you being in a toilet with Courtney Love and she was putting her makeup on you. Do you know what I mean? I mean, this is,
That was one of the first things that I did when I became a journalist. I'm working at the Mirror. I'm 21. I have no idea what I'm doing. I've come from a local newspaper where I wrote about a dog crossing a road. I got out of there in 8 months and I go and start working for Piers Morgan. But, you know, at the time, working for him was brilliant, you know, because he was such a supportive editor. Obviously, there's questions about the person nowadays, but that was brilliant because I was out on that scene and Courtney took me into the loo at the Lord of the Rings premiere. That's how old we are. And she took knickers out of her bag, put them on my head, said she'd do the interview while she's having a piss. And then comes out. She talked to me about Kurt. She, you know, she wasn't in a very good way. It was, you know, looking back on it, it wasn't really the best time to be interviewing someone. But at the end of it, I do remember that she kind of slapped me around the cheek and she said, "If you stitch me up, I will hunt you down, motherfucker." She just walked out. And I was like, that's showbiz, you know? That's someone that gets the game. We were all working out. I wrote a thrilling piece. She was really happy with it. She sent me a message about it. And, you know, Courtney is one of those celebs that's always had a source on the inside. You know, she's worked with the media and that's old school. It's not like that now.
No. And now it's kind of turned from a mutually beneficial relationship and a relationship of some respect and some trust to at least report fairly into showbiz journalists kind of turning into spies. You know, they have become people who get planted at the backstage area of festivals or in restaurants or clubs. I know that you have experience of that, of seeing that at least.
I mean, that was my first job. You know, I had to be a sleuth that was going to nightclubs. I was in China White with, you know, P. Diddy one night, Eve and Gwen Stefani the next, Spice Girls. You know, it was pretty full on.
You were invited to come and sit with them.
Well, I just sidle up. You know,
right,
at one point,
yeah.
I do remember being on a dance floor with all of these bodyguards, and it was just me, Diddy, my friend that had invited me, and I'm just having a chat with Diddy. And you know when you're like, God, what is going on? Like, I'm 22, I've just got into this industry, and I'm partying with P. Diddy. And by the way, you'd be going home at 5 a.m., we didn't have internet. We couldn't record anything. We couldn't go, oh, could I get some quotes? I was typing them in a Nokia 8210 and sending them to my editor going, yeah, remind me to tell you about that tomorrow when I got home blasted at 5 a.m. and then back at my desk by 10. Yeah, you were kind of living the rock and roll lifestyle that they were living, which was slightly worrying in some ways.
100%.
You kind of came out at the end of it. I remember I always kind of had a break before I changed jobs. And it usually involved a dark room, curtains closed, Golden Girls repeats, and just hoping that you could kind of get up after a few days and just feel normal.
You were the secret 3 a.m. boy, right?
That was the plan, yeah. So I kind of joined the girls when the 3 a.m. column, for those that don't know, was pretty much their height of celebrity gossip. And they weren't nice people. You know, they were there to push buttons and they were there to be proper showbiz journalists and have an opinion. They were kind of a bit like what people have got as power now. You know, they could say what they wanted about people and thought they could get away with it.
Right.
And in those days, you knew that you had to take some shtick to get your name out there and to be in that position. So even though they were kind of arch enemies between showbiz columnists and the celebrity, both parties knew that without one, the other wouldn't exist. So it was a different time.
Yeah, I remember my first understanding that the press weren't on my side or the press weren't necessarily to be trusted was 2009. This is going way back. I was with a singer called Will Young, who was huge in the UK at the time, and also one of the only openly like out gay singers, so there was like so much extra media interest in him at the time, and we were talking and having a very, you know, open chat at a festival bench together with a little table at it, and a journalist had been with us, and as soon as she got up to leave, we started chatting and I started really opening up to him about how I was struggling with what felt like very overnight success, and he just put his hand over my mouth immediately, just very, very quickly and firmly, and made a kind of silence gesture with his own hand and mouth, and then hit her phone. He hit her BlackBerry that she'd left at the table, and it was recording. And that was the first time I'd understood that, oh shit, so you can't say anything anyway, you can't do anything from the 3 a.m. girls in that column. I learned like to piss in complete silence and get in and wash your hands and get out of the toilet, because they would hide in the toilet cubicles to be able to hear what was being said by the celebrities. Like, I mean the girls.
No.
And it was hard to get to know anyone from your side. And I think really only you and one other woman were the two that I ever could have, like, trusted to even have a basic conversation with, because it felt like you felt like you were being hunted when you were on the receiving end of it.
I just to give you my side of things,
yeah,
and how I was thrown into it. You know, I was, if you imagine just being a 21-year-old that just got this job, I think I was 22, and I was told to go. I was like, you're on a flight to Amsterdam. And I thought, okay, cool. Wow, yeah. Amsterdam, that's so glamorous. You know, I'd only ever flown to, I think, New York to interview Shakira for 1 hour and then flown straight home. So I was like, Amsterdam sounds cool. And got there, and they said, right, when you get there, Robbie Williams is staying in the Grand Hotel. So we booked you a hotel room in the Grand. And I was like, wow. So
fucking
I'm
going to
stay at the Grand.
Yeah.
You know, they put some serious, they have money then. They've got no money now.
No.
And good. I kind of sat in reception after having a shower, and I'm all posh, you know, going, oh, cool. What's going to happen tonight? Robbie was probably at his worst with his addiction problems. It was the MTV Awards. Robbie never showed, but about 11 p.m. that night, Gareth Gates came down the stairs. And that was really my only option. So I had a photographer with me, and I had to, well, I checked with the news desk that they were keen, and I just had to trail him while he went through the red light district. And you can imagine what they did. It was, you know, pop star Gareth Gates. I think he was 18. I mean, he was so young.
Yeah.
And I exposed his night in Amsterdam, looking in windows, and he went to a club, which, let's face it, it was a very famous club in Amsterdam, which was known as a bondage club.
Right.
I mean, it was like one guy wearing leather in the corner of a room, but suddenly it was like a big deal. But you know, you look back on that and you just think, not only was I going to follow around Robbie, who I've got loads of respect for, and he really wasn't in a position to have a journalist following him around, I didn't really understand the implication of what I was doing as a person,
yeah,
to somebody like Gareth, who was 18 years old, you know. And I don't know whether he knows it was me. I didn't ever get to know him. I knew Will a bit, but you know, they were so famous, and you were just using their, you know, it was a 2 hour walk with their manager to paint them as different people.
100%. And I mean, this, look, there's so many things to discuss. I also want to make sure that I don't sit here from a position of like perfect little like princess and victim. You know, I was also somewhat halfway between the two cultures, because as much as I was a public figure, I was also a journalist, in that I was a TV journalist. So I was interviewing people on television, and I, you know, have spoken out for years about my regrets on T4 of being part of what was quite a snide culture of just hipsters who would be like provocative and rude to really famous people. And it felt like it was okay, because it was part of our British culture to kind of punch up. You know, you felt like, oh, well, if someone's more powerful than you and more famous than you, it's fair game to sort of like poke at them on live television. Mm. And it was something that I always felt hugely uncomfortable with. And I would always beg and like push back and not want to do it. I remember this kind of, the kind of breaking point for me was being trying to, was you know, a producer at T4 trying to force me to play a game with Tiny Temper, who's a rapper who, no, sorry, with Tinchy Strider, who's a rapper who's already small in his, he's already small in his stature, and that's why he's called himself that name, Tinchy Strider. And they wanted me to play a game with him called What Things in the World Are Bigger Than You? On live television, that he wouldn't be prepared for, where we go through things in the world that are bigger than him. And I'm already 5'11". I'm already significantly taller than this man on television. We live in a culture that belittles men who are shorter than women. And they want me to take a 21-year-old small black man and humiliate him on television as I tower over him. And I said, no, that was the final time where I was just like, no, fuck you guys. Like, this is it. I can't, like, just fire me. Yeah. And the producer threw a chair across a room in rage with me to kind of intimidate me, and then like stormed out of the room. And that was it. That's when I just moved to radio. I just didn't want to do it anymore. I couldn't be complicit in that, but I was still a bit complicit in it. I was still a bit snarky. I was still a bit rude. And it's only now that I have become an actor where I'm on the receiving end of that, that I understand how that feels. And so I do, you know, part of why I wanted you to come on here is not just to showcase you as someone who did that, but just to say that we were all hypernormalized in a culture that was really gross and weird and dehumanizing. The way I used to speak about celebrities online was so dehumanizing, and I fucking come to LA and I have to meet all of them, or my boyfriend works with them, and I have to apologize to them, even though they don't know about the thing. I just feel this need to like repent,
You know, I will tell you this. I kind of feel like at the moment, with what's happening with showbiz journalism, celebrity journalism, I don't know whether it's exactly the same in Los Angeles, but, you know, a lot of the old school people and all of us that were there in the old days, we've taken time out and we're looking at what's happening. And, you know, in light of loads of things that have happened in the last few months or years, you know, we're realizing what we did, you know, and we are repenting. We're going through... You know, when I was at one of the celebrity weeklies, Amy Winehouse died, Jay Goody died, Britney Spears had the biggest mental breakdown, and we basically treated her like a circus animal, you know, and it's a very hard discussion. And something, in a way, that I do want to pull you up on, Jamila, just because I think it's an important discussion that we think about the media in three separate ways.
Right.
I think there's a paparazzi problem.
Yeah.
There's a big problem. There's the publications themselves.
Yeah.
And then we've now got this problem with the public and the power that they
exactly.
have.
Exactly.
Because they've become the snarky showbiz reporter that we were 12 years ago. And that's really worrying, because you can't, you know, we're not going to be able to stop that. It's the internet. You know, people are going to say mean things. And it's very hard to manage a celebrity now. Like, I don't know how you deal with what you put yourself through.
I have struggled with handling being in the public eye. I've really struggled with knowing how to be my authentic self, but also not to the point where I make myself vulnerable to the world and where my vulnerability can't be used against me. As we know, because I've said in the public eye several times before, I have tried to take my life during the course of my career, because everything just got so overwhelming, and I am an emotionally vulnerable person who was in a world that I wasn't prepared for. But I also feel as though now it's become easier for me, because I've started to understand that this isn't all as personal as I think it is, that when I receive personal attacks, they're not necessarily specifically designed for me. I've started to wonder if there's a bigger pattern at play. And I feel as though I've been alive long enough to watch this happen to so many, in particular women, the build up, build up, build up, rip her down, that it feels so formulaic that I have started to feel as though, oh, this would have happened to anyone. Probably more so because I poke the bear more than my peers. I understand that. I take responsibility for that. I also fuck up more than my peers.
Hands up.
Yep. But it does feel as though I'm sometimes being used as an example, right? Like a don't speak out, don't be different, don't fight back against the press, otherwise this is what we'll do to you. Like kind of like a warning shot for other women in influence, or even just women in the world. Like don't stand up, don't stand out, don't speak out, otherwise you will be punished. And so there's something weirdly empowering in realizing that pattern. Because then it just kind of gives me a bit more of a feeling of, oh, no, fuck you then. I'm not going to play that game. Do you think in your, like, over the course of your time when you were working within tabloid media, like, am I crazy here? Is there a system of build her up, build her up, rip her down?
I mean, to be honest, isn't that celebrity? I kind of feel like that's part of the whole fame game. And I don't think it's necessarily something that's been introduced that recently. I think that if you look back to you know, Hollywood days, the royals, Diana, you know, it's something that's been brewing. And I think probably from Princess Diana is when that really went into the spectrum. And we really, that whole few years where she was coming to becoming who she was, the media obviously had a field day.
Mm.
And, there were other celebrities that were standing up and that were strong. There was the Madonna, you know, Madonna was like, having Playboy pictures of her nude being put in the press. The next day she was selling out Wembley and then she was thrown back down. You know, it's a format that works for the media, and it's a format that unfortunately I don't really think has disappeared in any way. I feel like at the moment with everything that's happening, I feel like women are getting a much bigger voice. I feel like there's some sort of movement with regards to the positive effect of social media, where people are finding their feet and they're actually saying, this isn't the way it should be. But, you know, let's look at a show like The X Factor. I was week in, week out interviewing the likes of Danny Minogue, who I became quite good friends with at one point, and Cheryl Cole, and all of these kind of play puppets that were on the television, you know, when you were back in the UK. And both of those girls didn't know what they were getting themselves into. They couldn't handle the machine that was at work amongst them. They didn't realise until it was kind of too late that they were the puppets and they were sat on those panels. And for that TV show, and, you know, I'm sure that Simon would hold his hands up, he played them. You know, they were the media puppet.
What do you mean?
One day everything would be good. I mean, as in,
if there was more controversy around their lives, then more people were tuning in to watch the show.
It was every slice of the pie. It wasn't just two slices that they could take. It was the element of the media wanting to know about their private life, every inch of their private life, who they were dating, who they were divorcing, what was happening with their babies.
Which one's thinner?
They were
pitting them against each other.
Well, that happened, yeah. You know. And do you remember that year when it was Danny versus Cheryl?
Mm.
That was so uncomfortable to watch, especially when I was on set and I was seeing what they were going through. And, you know, they, unfortunately, they probably would have gotten absolutely fine, but everyone was just going, oh, well, what do you think about Cheryl? You know, Cheryl looks like this. Or, you know, Danny was then being pitted against her for the fashion, being pitted against her for the size of her body, being pitted for what she says in the press. Every inch of it was just a lynch mob. It was really hard to watch.
But how is it such an organised system? That's the thing that I don't understand. And you may not even have the answer for this. But the thing that blows my mind is that it's the same thing again and again and again. Let's take Jennifer Lawrence, for example, right? She comes out of nowhere, right? She's 19, 20 years old, hilarious, really good at chat show interviews, super relatable, talking about farting and, you know, getting blackout drunk and throwing up in front of like Miley Cyrus, all these different things. Like, she was our relatable girl. She fell over when she was going to pick up her Oscar. We thought it was the most charming thing in the world. And then a year and a half goes by and the attitude is now, and I'm definitely holding the public responsible in also being complicit in this, but the attitude is like, oh God, it's her again, attention seeking, trying to be so over relatable. Like, oh look, she fell over again, probably faked that. Everything about her's insincere, stop pretending to be so relatable. It was so interesting to watch us hate her for the same thing that we had loved her for such a short period of time ago. And I talk about this a lot on my Instagram, where I think that I think the method is like, you build her up, hyperbolize how amazing you think she is. And then I think that you overexpose her, so the public becomes sick of her and starts to think that she's got a big head. Because if someone's being bigged up this much all the time, they must become a little bit arrogant. And if they're not constantly fighting all of the compliments all the time and constantly self-deprecating, then you think, she's bought into her own hype. Therefore, she's now primed for a takedown. So when the media starts savaging her with smears, or she's difficult, or she's unlikable, or she's been dishonest about this, etc., we're so, like, our appetite is ready.
Well, look at Taylor Swift. It's the same as Taylor. Like, she's just gone through exactly the same thing. And, you know, I have been thinking about this because I know that we touched on this earlier, but the different sides of when you say media, it has to encapsulate the public, because, you know, the power of, like, the meme and us waking up and seeing something written about Taylor, that can take people down. Look at Mel B when she went on to, you know, when Avid Merrian did his takeoff of Mel B. You know, he took her out. Craig David got taken out by
For anyone who doesn't know, this is a comedian in the UK. Lee Francis, who used to make some quite racially insensitive parodies of some people. I don't think he's a bad person, but it was, in hindsight, I think everyone's got some...
In a time when all of us didn't realise there was a racial issue.
Yes, exactly. But he would make these parodies, comedic parodies of famous people. And with a couple of them, it kind of like fucked up their careers. But I think a big part of my drive, a big part of my wanting you on this podcast, a big part of what I talk about online constantly regarding this media cycle is that there can't be another one. We cannot continue to sit back and watch another person take their life or have a nervous breakdown or develop an eating disorder or whatever, or lose their entire career that they did because they loved something, they were good at it, they got put on a pedestal over it and then kicked off. I'm trying to understand the system so I can figure out how we break it. It always feels like the media, even though they're all competing with each other, the publications, the ones that are competing with each other, are all still always on the same timeline of, we love her, we love her, she's amazing. Oh, she's made a mistake, we hate her. Die.
The trouble is, Jamila, I'll give you a very simple analogy of that.
Yeah, go on.
Misery sells.
Yeah.
Misery will always sell. You know, whether it's Kerry Katona, it's Jordan, it's Jennifer Lawrence, it's Taylor. If their life is in turmoil, they're going to sell copies. They're going to have clicks. They're going to have clickbaits. It's going to become more and more. The beast gathers pace.
Yeah.
That's the thing that we've got to break. If that could break, then we'll be halfway to solving it. But it's a really big issue.
And it's all women that you're naming. I'm not saying that men completely escape that disgrace, but we have a very different attitude. It's 95% women who go through that cycle, who we enjoy love a fallen woman.
Well, just look at Johnny Depp, Jamila. You know, all that's gone on in the court case and all that was dragged out and everything that we found out, he's kind of got away scot-free.
Yeah.
It's like he's going to continue his career as normal. He's not a woman. He's not been bashed. He's not going to run away. He's not got to Jennifer Lawrence disappear for like 4 years. He's probably shooting another film right now.
I mean, yeah, that's happened. Emil Hirsch, like Quentin Tarantino, all the things that loads of these people have been accused of. Yeah. I'm sure Casey Affleck will keep working. Shia LaBeouf thought he managed to get away with for years and years and years. Mm. And will probably still... I wouldn't be surprised if Shia LaBeouf is afforded like that big sort of GQ interview where he comes back and like he did after the last time he was accused of doing something heinous. He came in and did a big kind of heart-to-heart publicly and was like, you know, because of my childhood, I did this. And then he made a movie about how difficult his childhood was.
Yeah.
It wasn't as fucking hard as mine, not to be a judgmental prick, but I'm just saying, and I haven't hit anyone. But my point being that we make more space for men's redemption and we make absolutely no space for women's redemption. And I just want to figure out what that sickness is. Obviously it's misogyny and patriarchy, but like, why do we love a fallen woman so much?
Well, I guess for the media, they know that things are going to turn and that there's going to be an uplift and people are going to want to see somebody, you know, that the public will get behind them. They'll want to see them get back to normal. They'll want to see Jordan recover from her foot operation, or they'll want to see Megan get back on her feet and do something good for children or whatever she's going to do with her
charity. Do you think that they actually feel that way? Because I don't know if that bit exists. I don't think that bit exists for women. I don't think we are actually hoping. I think we can't believe it. I think the women who come back or stick around are the anomaly. And I think actually what the media expects to happen is we will disgrace her. And then because in particular, women are set up with the belief system that we must be approved of and liked by everyone, she'll just fuck off and then there'll be a new one. I don't think we're ever planning on the comeback or hoping for the comeback. And when it works, sometimes the media gets behind it. But it's very rare that I think they're ever planning on the comeback of a woman.
I guess that Meghan is very lucky in the respect of the US because they're kind of sticking a lot more behind it than what the UK are. You know, and the UK media, I think they're done. I don't think there's going to be much for a comeback for Meghan as far as the media are concerned over here. But saying that, there's still publications like Broadsheets that will work with her on her dress campaign for the charity that she works with, Smartworks, and they'll put her on a cover and they'll give her an opportunity to speak. You know, they still want a part of her, but whether they're supporting her fully or they're just looking at their sales.
Yeah. But is it so... is there ever a conversation about it of we love her now or we hate her now? You know what I mean? Like, you know, like there are these editorial meetings in the morning sometimes.
Conferences.
Yeah. They are. Like, they're conferences. I remember my mate who worked at one of the bigger tabloid newspapers.
I know.
Referred to it as the vagina monologues. That's what the morning meeting was referred to, because the male editor would call every woman that they were discussing, every woman in the public eye, a cunt. And so therefore, because that's the word he would use about all these different famous women, none of whom he knew personally. That was how much he dehumanized them and degraded them in that meeting, which is full of female journalists, by the way. So he's just saying that openly about women in front of loads of women. They then like laughingly referred to those meetings as the vagina monologues. Like, there was a briefing about like, who do we hate today? Who do we love today? Well, how long are we going to love them?
I was at the Mirror in like, 2001? We did this thing that started called the 1,000 Most Irritating People in Britain. And every day we just berate someone for who they were. You know, that was that time. I kind of hope that where we are now, things have slightly moved on, because I don't know about things being run like that. I think that there has been a lot of progression in UK media. You know, we touched on this when we spoke before, but what Edward Enninful has done coming into Vogue and putting black people on the cover, like they should have been like 30 years ago, you know, that was a huge thing, because when I was working for magazines, we weren't allowed to put black people on the cover because they would not sell. Now we've got an editor that has gone to the biggest fashion magazine, which was so white, it was unreal, and it was so conservative in its morals. We're now seeing someone that's come in and trailblazed. That's a huge fucking deal.
Isn't
to
that
see someone doing
unbelievable that in the last
but
20 years?
But
also, isn't that unbelievable that 20 years ago you would be explicitly told that we can't put a black person on the cover because no one will buy it?
You know? Yeah. It just didn't happen. It was that, I think the only time I vividly remember there being a black person on the cover was Naomi Campbell chucking her phone at her assistant, and that went everywhere.
Yeah.
That was a really rare occasion. And it just, you know, not even Beyonce, you know, these people were huge stars, but it wouldn't sell for them, and they weren't willing to take any risk on any sort of sale that would flop. So if there was a chance, even a 10% chance that, oh, actually, maybe Jennifer Anderson's a bit overexposed this week, let's not go down that, we'll put Posh on instead. Or Katie Price has got a new boo job. Or, you know, it was so ridiculous what you were having to kind of make judgment calls on.
Mm.
But, yeah, it's shocking looking back on it.
It's terrifying. And it's amazing how we all fall in line and how much I remember.
It was normalised.
Yeah, well, I used to fall in line. You know, I've said this publicly before on this podcast and in writing, that I look back at how many times I used to watch like Anne Hathaway's Oscar speech. Which now I look back with a different lens of not being a fucking bitch. And I remember I used to look at it being like, oh my God, that's so cringe. And I would like show it to other people and be like, this is so cringe. I look back at it now and I'm like, that's a really young woman who did an amazing thing, who was going through a lot emotionally and fucking prepared an Oscar speech. Like, I would prepare an Oscar. I'm obviously never going to even be invited to the Oscars. But like, if I did,
well,
you're standing in front of fucking,
be.
You're standing in front of Brad, Angelina, Jack Nicholson, like Meryl Streep. You're not going to just wing it, are you? But we hate the idea of a woman being like prepared, of having planned, of having maybe expected it. How dare she have maybe thought she could have won in order to have even pre-rehearsed that speech? It is, we just have to all look out for this in ourselves and just continue to make sure that we don't help this cycle. That was all. It was kind of like a period where I feel like media outlets sync up. With loving someone, and then starting their downfall, and just knowing that the public are such that, you know, we the sheeple will just fall in line. We have to stop falling in line. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now listen, we all carry around different stresses, big, small, medium size, and a lot of us keep them bottled up because sometimes we just have to. But doing that all of the time can really, really start to negatively impact your life. And I say that from experience. I'm British. We are told to never say how we're feeling about anything ever. And that's why so many of us are so sad. Now, a way that I was able to remedy that was by having therapy, which was super helpful for me, not only because it's amazing to get things off your chest, but also all week, you know, as you're bottling things up, because it's not always the time or place to say exactly how you feel, you know, you're going to get that hour
where you're able to get everything off your chest and say it exactly as you want to. And this therapist isn't going to take it personally, and they're not going to hold it against you or throw it back in your face during an argument over dinner next week. You just have this complete freedom. Honestly, I think everyone should have therapy, regardless of whether they think they need it, because it's so amazing to have a confidant. It's a journal that talks back to you and helps you with all of your problems. I think therapy is just a safe space to get everything off your chest, to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, then maybe you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be super convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And then you can switch therapists if you don't like them anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/iWay today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/iWay.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley, in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Will you tell me why you first got into showbiz?
Yeah.
I love this reason.
Well, I really wanted to meet Madonna. That was basically the crux of things. And may I add, I'm just going to show you.
Did you meet Madonna?
I met Madonna.
Oh, my God. Dean but, is know, holding up a picture with him and Madonna. Will you send that to me? Send me a picture of that so I can post it with this interview.
But I tell you, the real funny story is the way that I actually got into it, because I worked at a post-production house and we mass-produced all of Madonna's videos.
Right.
The company next door did. And because I was such a huge fan, they'd always go, oh, my God, do you want to see the new Madonna video? I'd be like, yeah. So I got the video and I wanted to help her get to number one. And it was the video that she did for Music with Ali G. And I took a punt and I text, well, I must have texted Dominic Mohan and Matthew Wright, who were at the Mirror and the Sun. I said, oh, I've got the new Madonna video. You know, is that worth something? Because I had a canary yellow Fiesta that I needed to keep on the road. And to be frank, I was getting paid $8,000 a year. So my morals were left slightly at the door. And within an hour, Matthew Wright had picked up the video and they did a kind of washout for the video. And it went straight to number one, which looking back on it was pretty shady to do. And especially, I have told Madonna's publicist, by the way, so I'm not being that shady nowadays. But it was about, that was what it was about. And I kind of fell into this job that kind of just took me on a bit of a mad ride, really. I think there's certain celebrities that are able to deal with the machine.
Yeah.
And there's a number that can't.
Yeah, I think some people get into it because they crave it. And then others, a bit more like me, like at least the first time around, I really had no idea what I was doing. And the second time around, I just never thought that in such a huge country, I would make a dent. So I just went into it again, slightly naively.
It's probably why you've got away with it and you're feeling so much happier. I hope you're feeling happier.
I'm feeling much happier. Yeah. It's easier to just sort of blend in here. Yeah. Last year was too much. But other than that, I've had a great time. And here I feel as though, you know, the UK is a very specific melting pot and fishbowl of only a couple of celebrities. There's a handful and they just get rotated and rinsed and overexposed. It's why, you know, I think a lot of countries around the world are looking at the way that the British tabloids have handled Meghan, Duchess Meghan, and just been like, how has this happened? How has this become so out of control? And it's because there's such a tiny circulation of people that the tabloids are obsessed with. That
I mean,
that it's just like, it's too much to even like fucking breathe. Go on.
But I mean, when I was at Closer magazine, for example, we had four names that we were able to put on the cover. And it was a little bit like what happened in the US, I think, because it was always Jennifer Aniston or yeah. Angelina that would really sell, you know, because of the Brad Pitt drama. But we had Katie Price, we had Posh Spice, Victoria Beckham, she would always sell, Cheryl Cole. And it was so monotonous. And Kerry Katona, who, if you're in the US, you might not have heard of. But it was a constant.
She was a reality. Kerry Katona
was an Atomic Kitten.
She was an Atomic Kitten and then kind of became a household name because we became kind of obsessed with her.
Yeah.
Her lifestyle. And a lot of that was around the sort of sadder parts of her life, like shaming her body or, you know, her going through relationship problems that would be hugely documented upon. With or without her consent. And so she became a kind of...
I did think about this earlier, which I have a bit of trouble with. Because I feel like certain people like Katie Price, certain people like Kerry Katona, they're a really rare breed in this business because in the old days, they fueled a lot of what was going on.
Yeah.
So much money was passing hands. Like, it was a joke. Yeah. You know, we're talking like $100,000 to do an interview. It was that amount of money, just for one interview. And nowadays, you won't even get a couple of grand. Like, it's just not. You'll get an interview for PR, but the value of a celebrity interview has just gone through the floor because it's all done. It's all out there on social. And Kerry and Katie in particular, you know, it was literally getting to the point where you thought they were having a baby to get the magazine deal.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite troubling.
It is quite troubling, although there is at least a kind of like feeling of a bit more consent, even though those people maybe weren't mentally stable enough necessarily to handle the onslaught of what comes with that consent that you give. I mean, I've had paparazzis like reach out to me on DM. I was telling you this the other day, being like, hey, I take, you know, I'm hired by the Kardashians to like take their photographs, you know, so that they'll always look flattering or whatever in their like regular day-to-day pap shots. And I can do the same for you. And I was like, no, thanks, mate. I'm not trying to fucking caught the paparazzi, like I'm, and you know, if they're businesswomen, they're flaunting their products, I get it, like whatever, I'm not shading them, I'm just saying that this is a whole culture where there are some who do actually plant the photographers, who plant the stories, who create kind of branding whirlpools, but a lot of people,
I always feel like we need to remember that the Kardashians are basically the Katie Price of America. Do you know
that's
what I mean?
Why it's I bring not, them up, yeah, just to kind of contextualize really it more globally.
Yeah, exactly. It's across the pond, and it's pretty much the same stuff.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So, okay, so what were some of the more disturbing things that you saw or heard in your time?
I mean, I kind of want to talk about Caroline Flack, just because I feel like right now it's a conversation that everybody is online and they're all saying be kind and they're all saying all of this stuff about how we've got to just be nicer people. But I feel like we very easily dropped that to the side. And I feel like my relationship with Caroline was interesting. I broke the story about her and Harry Styles, which at the time was a huge deal.
Yeah.
He was 18. She was 32, I think.
34, and I think, article,
was it 34?
I think so, yeah.
And yeah. And the article that I wrote, I was pretty derogatory about her. I didn't know her that well at that point, but that article really affected her quite a lot. And whereas a lot of showbiz journalists, you know, that was quite a big story. And obviously it went on for weeks because the tabloids would just repeat everything and then try and get a comment and then it would just move forwards. And I think they saw each other for a little bit.
How did you break the story? Just out of curiosity. How did people find this shit out?
That came babe, in those days, Harry was on the set of X Factor. He was literally a kid and they were putting together One Direction. She was presenting on Extra Factor and somebody saw them going to a broom cupboard and the broom cupboard shut and they were there for a while. And that was how it all started. But then it did turn out that they were seeing each other and it was, you know, they were kind of hooked up on, they were into each other. But the thing that I was really regretful about and the thing that caused Caroline a lot of pain was the fact that towards the end I put something like as the payoff, because this one's not creepy because of the age difference. And that was a derogatory to a woman because it was she was on the other foot. We wouldn't even comment on a man's age. And the thing that I'm quite glad about is that we had a couple of rocky years, obviously, you know, a couple of stand-up blazing rows.
But had you been friends before that? Had you been sort of like friendly?
A little bit, but I wasn't really, I was quite young back then and I didn't have many huge celebrity friends.
Yeah.
It wasn't like we would go out for dinner or anything like that. I didn't feel like I owed her anything, but, you know, yet again, it was using someone's personal life for a paper's monetary gain. And it didn't leave a very healthy taste in your mouth. And ultimately, that's probably why I couldn't do that job for any longer, because you start to overstep the mark and you realise that people are actually just humans and we need to be a bit more respectful and a bit kinder to people. And then towards the end, you know, we were really good mates. I look after a retreat in Ibiza and she'd been out there and we were in touch a lot on WhatsApp and I was trying to like really try quite shortly before she died, get her to go to a retreat and kind of lock herself away. And it's troublesome that she didn't go, because there are a number of factors. I mean, she was addicted to social media. She was addicted to fame. And she was one of those people that she wasn't meant to be famous like this.
Mm.
She couldn't handle it was very hard on her.
But also, like, we're not, women in particular are not given any kind of like manual when we enter this industry. We are not told explicitly you're going to be treated completely differently to how your male counterparts are going to be treated. You're going to be held to different standards. We are going to become obsessed with you. We are going to slash your tires. That's what they did to her. The paparazzi would slash her tires so that she would come out, see the tires, look upset, and then they would take the upset photograph and attribute it to the big story that was going on. Mm. This is how she was being hounded and stalked. This is how everyone gets hounded and stalked. I talked about the stalking of me. I know about what, you know, I watched what happened to Amy because I lived around the corner from her, Amy Winehouse, that is. Like, you know, that was just a cloud of screaming men you don't know. And as a woman, you can't help but your senses, like your kind of like anthropological instincts, are to feel like you're about to get attacked. When you are surrounded, it's late at night. There are all these flashes going on. You can't see straight. None of these people have like a press pass to be around you, these paparazzi in particular. There's no kind of certification. You just have to be normally a bloke with a big camera, an SLR camera, with a big zoom on it. And then that just qualifies you as someone who's allowed to stalk someone and sit outside their house all day long. And so you do feel like you might get like sexually assaulted or something, because they're just all around you. They're all screaming at you and you feel like you can't logically override the fear that you're about to die. But that's what it feels like sometimes, especially if you're in an alley on your way home or right outside your front door. One of them could just be a stalker. Just stab you right there and then. It was just also wild.
Half of the women that have to go through all this as well, they're literally the most insecure people in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, they're people that have so many demons that you don't quite know how they do what they do and why they put themselves through it, because you're like, ooh.
Well, we're told it's normal. That's the thing, right? So we're told by our publicists, we're told by our teams, by our managers, like, that's just how it is, babe. Don't take it personally. Like, just rise above, turn the other cheek. Just, you know, don't respond. When someone slanders you publicly, don't respond. Don't add to it. Don't fuel the fire. So you just have to sit there and it's so hyper-normalized, just like it is for you, just like it is for the paparazzi, just like it is for us, or just like it was for us at T4. Like, it's fine. It's a joke. They can take a joke. It's fine to make fun of 15-year-old Justin Bieber to his face. Like, he'll get it. It's a laugh. We're all just having a laugh. It's all just fun. It's show business. It's glitter. It's glamour. Mm. And you just don't, you can get caught in this kind of hate. And not to excuse any of the worst offenders in this, because there's been enough evidence documented over the years now. It's not just Caroline Flack. It's not just Meghan. It's not just the Britney documentary. We have seen since 2007, when Britney had that breakdown, that's when this shit should have stopped rather than turned up a gear. But you're right in that the public are why it has gone on to become so explosive. And I say this all the time on my social media, that we are funding patriarchy, we are funding misogyny, we are funding the like attacks of vulnerable women in particular when we click on these articles or when we buy these magazines. They are only supplying our demand. And we as a public have a massive responsibility. It's the biggest problem. If we didn't buy it, they would stop selling it. There was a time where this didn't exist because they didn't know that there was an appetite. I think, do you agree with me that the turning point was just that we were sick of seeing airbrushed perfection and glamour and wealthiness? And we were like, there was a kind of, there was a sickness of seeing this kind of like perfect bubble, and the first time that bubble was kind of pricked and we showed you the fall down of like a Drew Barrymore or a, you know, who, you know, went through addiction issues when she was younger, et cetera. When we started to shame them or show that they would have weight struggles too, or they had acne too, or they were going through a divorce, they were getting cheated on. There was a public appetite for that because we were sick of the perfect veneer, and everything just went too far after that. We all have a responsibility.
Just to show you the other side, but I mean, when I was at one of the magazines and I went into conference, I had a filthy hangover. I'd been at some premiere or something, like I used to all the time. And I had my shades on, and there was a picture of Keira Knightley, Tori Spelling and Nicole Richie, and they were really thin, you know, horrible pictures taken from a bus. All, you know, everything was bony. And I would just, without thinking, I just went, oh, bones are back, and just thought nothing of it. Went back to my desk. Oh, yeah, cool. Could you write 800 words on bones are back for the cover? And I went, huh? And it said bones are back, and the three of them were lined up. And it sold 750,000 copies, which was one of the biggest sales of that year. A, I've got to deal with the fact that that came from me being a complete dick and having a hangover and just looking at pictures and making a comment. But B, oh God, don't buy this shit. If you buy it, they're going to put more of it out there. You know, they're going to put more torment and more hurt and more judgment on women's bodies. And, you know, being truthful, I think a lot of those magazines are struggling now. I think the tide has turned, and I think, fortunately, the one good thing that's come from social media, from online and this clickbaiting, which keeps people permanently on their phones, is the fact that they're not buying magazines and they are struggling. There's no advertising. And you never know. I don't even, you know, there's already dead. They're down to like six of them being left. So maybe there is a turning point that's coming from the fact that we're in a pandemic, as well as all of the other factors that are going into this. You know, there's no bugger going out being papped at the moment. So there's a lot less to put in those pages, which is great.
So aside from being sent out as like a plant sometimes, and aside from being, you know, sent to interview someone, you had mentioned to me that, which I found fascinating and I've always wondered about, and I've been warned about this by other, you know, actors, etc. You said that they would sometimes already have the headline before you would even interview the celebrity, right? So that I'm not saying specifically you, but like they would do that with journalists, right? Where they had the headline already planned, they had the storyline planned. And so you were just going to kind of, not you, sorry, as in the journalists would go to fulfill a narrative that had already been decided before.
Every week.
Oh, so it was you.
Yeah, of course it was. Yeah. You know, it was, that was part of the reason that I had to leave, because celebrity journalism now, Jamila, as you know, you know, you're a 24-year-old that's working for the Mail Online or one of those other titles where you come in and you just sit there and you're just typing up what happened on social media last night. There's not much to it. Anybody could kind of learn how to write the basics. But the reality was that in my last 4 years, I was working at a tabloid and, you know, I'd go out and I'd do, I don't know, Danny Minogue, Sharon Osbourne, Victoria Beckham. And as you were leaving, they go, oh, yeah, we want that line about Ashley Cole, or we want that line about her weight. Get her to talk about her kids. Is she going to have kids? Is she pregnant? You know, it was all of those lines that would end up with a front page splash. I don't want to do it that way round. That's not the way that we did it, like near to 15 years ago when I first started. We didn't know what the hell was going to happen. We didn't know what story was going to come up. We didn't know if Callum Best was going to snog that page Rego in the corner. You know, that was something that would happen off the cuff, but that's the way that journalism should be. It shouldn't be the headline being written before you even get to the interview, because then I was going in kind of with this nervous anxiety going, shit, what if I talk to Victoria Posh Spice and she just won't talk about David, or she won't talk about kids, or she just wants to talk about her velour tracksuit that she's wearing. I don't know. You know, there were all of these things. So as a journalist, you were going in with the added pressure of knowing that you almost were going to stitch someone up. You know, get Victoria on her way. Get Cheryl on her divorce. Get this. I don't want to fucking talk to her. You know, I'm going to sit down with a celebrity who's a household name. Try not to swear, by the way. I do swear quite a lot.
Yeah, you can swear on this podcast. I said cunt earlier. Sorry.
Oh, God. Okay. And you'd sit down with them and you just feel like a really bad person. And I've caught up with people like Cheryl Cole since. I bumped into them and kind of not apologised, but I kind of feel like it gets to a point where you just have to be a bit more honest and just admit, which a lot of showbiz journalists who, you know, the big names, they won't admit it because they're just thick-skinned, scaly, horrible people.
Yeah, there They've is not a, got a heart. There's a bloodthirst to some journalists, the ones who've stayed in this game for a long
only
time.
There's only a few that actually have any warrant to still be doing it because, to be frank, showbiz journalism is quite weird right now.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as powerful as what it was.
No, because everyone can control their own narratives and people speak back now. We're not listening to our publicists anymore, just being like, don't respond. We respond constantly. Yeah. And sometimes that, I mean, more often than not, that goes tits up for all of us. But at least we have a chance to say our own, you know, piece. And a big part of me having this podcast was just my chance to finally be heard on my own terms, in my own words, in my own tone of voice, rather than via the lens of, you know, like the fact that I have to, I video any journalist who's recording me for print now. I make sure that they know that they're being filmed so that if they stitch me up, I will release the footage of that interview of what I actually said. Like, that's how things have to be now. I'm fucking terrified.
We would have just gone, no, we're not doing Jamila. No, no, we're not going through that. I would have just walked out. Have you had people walk out?
No. No, because they want the interview. Really? Because, well, currently I've got currently I have value. I'm sure there'll be a time where they're just like, no, fuck off. But they also know that I'm so fucking scary that if you say no and you walk out, I'll just tweet about it.
Yeah.
So I'll
can I ask you one other question?
Yeah, go on.
I just want to ask you.
You can ask me anything.
I know, I'm asking loads.
No,
stuff.
I love that.
But with celebrity podcasts in particular, because that is what I see as the future right now.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like a lot of people are dodging, you know, going to sit down with some old horrible witch from some broadsheet.
We know, we both know exactly which witch you're referring to, but we won't name her. But go on.
Lots of witches. But, you know, I feel like instead of doing that interview, which, let's be honest, it'll give them a nice front cover of the Times or the Telegraph or whatever they want to do. The thing that I find questionable in a discussion is if that A-lister is going on a podcast, they've got a lot of power. They're able to present themselves as they want to kind of come across. Is that a shame that we're not able to get a true depiction of what that person is? Or is it only going to work with some celebrities and other celebrities will be true to their word and as they are?
I don't know. Like, I feel as though not only do I give more honest sides of myself on this podcast, I feel like I'm the most myself I've ever been on this podcast. But I also feel as though my guests are more themselves in my podcast than they would be when they're opposite someone who traditionally we identify with being there to stitch us up or to take us out of context or to fulfill a narrative, because they know that I'm not going to edit them in any way. I'm just going to leave the conversation as is. They trust me and they open up and they know that they're being at least heard. They have the opportunity to be heard in their own words. When you're in a print interview, there's no opportunity. I mean, I literally, almost every interview I have ever done, they have just taken words out of a full paragraph that I said and used it to construct a brand new sentence with a different meaning. And so then I look like a fucking twat on the headlines of, and the headlines go viral and everyone only reads the headlines and then, you know, indulgently rolls their eyes at me. And I'm well aware of what the perception of me out there on Twitter is because of these headlines that were written by fucking women, which is incredibly infuriating. But this has given me the autonomy to be able to, you know, much to my publicist terror, I'm sure, because of how open I am on this podcast. But this just has given me the chance to take it back and actually, you know, be myself and not fear who I am. The reason that we're able to be so controlled on our side by publicists, by the media, that we're so terrified of the press, is because we are made to feel as though who we really are isn't good enough. What we really look like isn't good enough, so it needs to be photoshopped. How we speak isn't good enough, so it needs to be crafted by a journalist. Like we are chipped away at and told that we're just these defenseless, opinionless, kind of useless little pretty dolls who just need to be quote unquote protected. And so we believe that. I believed that when I was 22.
Does it change with London and LA? Is there a difference between how the publicist kind of works or...
I don't know. I think I'm just old. So I think that everyone knows that I'm just sort of not going to listen. You know, I direct my publicist.
You're a publicist disaster nightmare.
I am. I totally am. No. But I was very controlled by my publicists when I was younger, and they would make comments about my weight. And when I would tell them I was struggling when I was telling them I was struggling with my mental health, they would roll their eyes at me as if I was being difficult. And at 26 was the second time I'd tried to take my life. And it was only after that that they started to understand that that this is serious, that when we're struggling, we're not just poor little rich girl. We're like, we're collapsing under the pressure of the scrutiny of this industry. And so I felt like I worked for them. Whereas now it's very much the other way around, where I explained to my publicist, this is what I'm going to do. You're either in or you're out. And I have a diehard group of women who are just like, we're all in for all of your all of your chaos.
I feel like it has started to really change.
It has changed.
There's a big seismic shift.
Yeah. Post Me Too, I think that women are allowed to have more opinions, and we're not called difficult or moaning as much when we express an opinion. When we say, I feel mistreated, we're somewhat heard unless we're Meghan Markle. And then we're just like the devil from hell, you know, which is how she gets treated every time she, you know, opens her mouth about anything or does anything.
Do you know what? I'm only going to touch on this quickly because I don't want to get drawn in, because I always do. But I feel the one thing that I really, really don't like about the whole story is I really wish the royal family would have realised that they could have modernized themselves.
Yeah.
This didn't need to happen.
Yeah.
I feel it's a very simple way of thinking that, look, they're not going to get on the throne. They're not going to cause problems. They can do their job. Just change up the way it is. We're not in the 1800s. It's things have changed. It's such a shame that the royal family can change. And I feel like that is ultimately the crux of the entire issue.
Yeah.
And probably the biggest regret that the Queen's going to have about it.
Well, neither of us want to get into any kind of mysterious accident. So let's not talk about that any longer.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
I do think things are changing. They're not changing fast enough. My hope is that with the rise of the Britney doc, the Paris Hilton doc, all this like us, there's a lot of on social media, I don't know if you're seeing this or not, of us going back over old interviews that at the time we thought were funny or we blamed the woman for or thought she was
or
being...
TV shows, or we thought
she was being uncomfortable. We thought Janet Jackson just wasn't playing along. You know, that's what it was called, like playing along. You know, when David Letterman is like trying to push you and humiliate you about your nipple coming out of the Super Bowl, which you've been disproportionately blamed over rather than Justin Timberlake, who pulled your fucking tit out in the first place. So fucking pissed at him for so many reasons. But I... yeah, hashtag fuck that guy. but when she was just trying to be like, oh, I don't really want to talk about that, we would make her seem like she's no fun, and that's how she would be treated. And yeah. No was treated as a maybe, when Paris or her or any of these women would be like, oh, Dave, I don't really want to talk about this anymore. Letterman would keep pushing. You know, it's
Paris is a force to be reckoned with. I mean, that woman, I've known her on and off for donkey's years. And the thing about her is she's involved in every aspect of that business. You don't, like, behind the scenes, this is like a £500 billion business that she's built. And I think now that she's able to, you know, she's not partying and going out like she was. Good. She's going to be around for donkey's years. Like, she's still going to be going like Zsa Zsa Gabor, selling perfume at the age of 80. I mean, she's so fearless and thick-skinned, and I've kind of got quite a lot of respect for her. I'm not sure if that's how you feel or not.
I definitely feel that way. After seeing her documentary in particular, I slid into her DMs to tell her just how...
I didn't
think she'd ever read it, but I just wanted to tell her how moved I was by that documentary, because I had no idea what she'd gone through as a child and just how extraordinarily resilient she is. And reading that stuff about the fact that she was just a teenager when that sex tape was leaked one night in Paris. Yeah.
That age... wasn't even a conversation. We didn't even question.
No, we blamed her. We blamed her.
We literally said, "Oh, she's a slag." So no.
I don't even remember when it happened, but I just remember. You know, I also remember all the memes about Britney. Like, if Britney can get through 2007, you can get through today. Oh, and it's like a picture of her with a shaven head, like trying to break into a paparazzi's or break a paparazzi, you know,'s window with an umbrella or whatever she was holding. Mm. I know that with the paparazzi, they are. They have this tactic. I spoke to a few once I'd kind of left the limelight, and they didn't know who I was in America. So I got chatting to some who were standing outside Catch, which is a restaurant in Los Angeles. And I was just kind of, you know, I'm a civilian at this point. So they have no interest in me, no idea who I am. They think I'm curious and I want to get into being paparazzi. And I just wanted to understand, because I was so traumatized by the paparazzi in the UK. And I was like, so how do you guys get ready to torment the person who's coming out, or like, how do you feel about standing out here? Like, what does it feel like? What should I be prepared for if I do this?
Yeah.
And they said that they purposefully dehumanize the celebrity before they even leave the house that day. So, or while they're standing outside, they in their heads, as a way to protect themselves from the guilt of what they're doing, because you're face to face with someone, you can see that they're squirming, they're uncomfortable, they feel crowded or invaded or stressed or afraid, and you just keep going, you keep leaning in on that. And the only way that they're able to do that is by telling themselves, well, they think they're better than us, they're this like fancy rich celebrity like crying in their castle, like they think that we're a piece of shit, they treat us like we're rodents, and they don't care about us, they don't care about the people, so fuck these people, we should expose them. And they kind of have this kind of mantra that they tell themselves in the morning before they leave for quote unquote work. And I
this
wonder
feels very Scientology to me.
I know, but it's really but it is really interesting. And this was quite a few of them were telling me this. They were just like, well, you know, as far as we're concerned, they don't give a shit about us, so why should we give a shit about them? And they are treated with disdain by some people in the public eye. So I can imagine how that feeling gets reinforced, because they are like spat on, or their cameras are broken, or like they're physically attacked sometimes by celebrities. We've seen the videos. But there is this kind of deliberately dehumanizing factor. And I sometimes wonder if some of the people who are still in the game, still at the top of the game of like breaking stories about celebrities, like invading their privacy, like crafting the narrative, I wonder if they must have to dehumanize the celebrity in order to be able to go out and do this. Did you ever see anything like this or hear anything like this? Like a way of talking about them that was dehumanizing?
I mean, look, to be honest, I remember when I first started going to Los Angeles, I became friends, a little bit friends, with Perez. And he was explaining up. Perez Hilton.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, obviously had his little moment and that's passed. But he one night said, oh, meet me down at the Abbey. And I kind of went, okay, cool. So I went and met him at the Abbey, just in West Hollywood. And I said, why are we here? And I kind of wasn't really sure. And then Britney came in and she was in a private area just on this little stage. And I remember being really alarmed that night because he clearly had someone that was literally with Britney who had called him and said to come because she was going to be there.
Mm.
They've got people on the inside, you know, and this really leads to such a huge amount of trust issues that, and it's probably exactly the same now. You know, I'm friends with people, well, like Poppy Delevingne and Chloe and their little sister Cara has experienced the same kind of thing because they've, you know, they become very famous.
Supermodel Cara Delevingne, just for anyone who doesn't know.
She was always just Cara, like 14-year-old with a guitar behind her back.
I know.
You know, that's kind of how that was. And I always find the LA side of things a lot more frantic and scary because the paparazzi are completely fearless. I don't find it as bad in London whatsoever. I find it really quite troublesome when it comes to Los Angeles.
I feel differently. I feel the media, the press is so much worse with
but
me
is
in
that
the UK.
Paparazzi or is that
both? It's paparazzi paper. And press, and it's the photos. Like the places that I've, the only time I've ever had a camera shoved between my thighs, like up my crotch, was in London. Or one time I was in the back of an Addison Lee, that's just a car company but that used to predominantly take people back and forth from events. But I was in the back of like a big people carrier and they opened the doors of the people carrier that I'd run into to get away from them. They opened all like four doors and, and I had a driver in the car who was screaming, who didn't know what was happening. And they got into the car with their cameras and were just flashing in my face. They jumped into my car outside Soho House. Would you feel comfortable sharing one of your bigger heartbreak moments that you spoke to me about on our kind of pre-chat of realizing the way that you were seen even by people that you were friends with? And I'm talking about the Peaches, Geldof. Situation.
Yeah. I mean, so Peaches Geldof, for those in America, she was the daughter of Paula Yates and Bob Geldof of Band-Aid fame. And she kind of rose up very quickly into the celebrity world and
socialite, DJ and stuff.
Yeah, she was doing everything. She had some TV work. She was a presenter for a bit. She was a really brilliant writer. She had two kids. She was with this kind of rocky, vampy, wonderful guy who was her husband, and I got to know her really well. And she was kind of one of the first ilk of celebrities that I really became friends with. And we had loads of hilarious adventures. And, you know, I took her out everywhere and kind of put her under my wing and made sure that I kind of protected her from the likes of Closer. And, you know, we'd do like Peaches column and she'd talk about celebrity in her own Peaches way. Hyper intelligent, very opinionated. To be honest, she's not that dissimilar from where you are. And I think that if she would be alive, because she sadly died from a heroin overdose, I think you and her would probably be kind of a meeting of minds.
And we went to school together, so I remember her. Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense. You know, it really does. And I went to her wedding, which was fantastic. I think Hello covered it, you know, because she wanted to get it all paid for. And it was in the back garden of Bob's house with their own little church. It's really cute. And, you know, she was a very good friend. We'd talk about the celebrity world and she'd have an opinion on everything. And then she died and I wasn't allowed to a funeral because Bob, well, I guess it was Bob, you know, it was his decision. Didn't want anyone that was anything to do with the tabloids being there. And it's kind of.
And at this point, you were like 4 years out of it, right? You had left the tabloids.
I was out of the tabloids. You know, I had a phone call from a friend of mine that's a journalist who told me that Peaches died, and it kind of hit you like a ton of bricks. Yeah, this was much more than anything that had happened before. And I feel like when you're in the tabloid world, it's a stigma that it's going to stick with you for a long time. It's only just started to leave me now.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of benefits to being former tabloid because I know the way that machine works. And I know all of the twats on the papers that you need to avoid and all of the people that work on the news desk. And I know the paparazzi to avoid. And I know what clubs to go to so that you're not in that vicinity. You know, I know all of that machine. And now I'm doing PR. I now know that side of stuff. So I now can guide these people through. And it has been funny because people like Katie Price, for example, she has you know, at one point wanted to work with me, but she wouldn't work with me because I was a former tabloid reporter. And I was like, what? I was like, your entire career is about the machine and, you know, whipping up a storm. And they won't work with me because of that.
But I think it's fascinating that you've moved into PR because you are now, there is no one better skilled than you to protect someone against what they're up against because you know the inner workings of it. What were the conversations like, can I just ask, between you and like other people who were in your circles? Were there at the time, yeah, back in the day, like, was there any kind of sense of, fuck, what are we doing? Or at the time, was it just hyper-normalized? Or was, you know, was there a culture of egging each other on? Yeah, I'm talking about your peers back then at the time. Like, how does it work? Is there any kind of anyone saying, I mean, I imagine it was probably you, knowing from having seen you at the time. Was there any, were there any conversations of accountability or what the fuck are we doing? Or was it just so hyper-normalized?
Not at all. There wasn't one. It was everyone. If you imagine having a massive shot of adrenaline and you're in a viper's nest and you just want to bite the competition out of the way to get further up the ladder and get the story and get further than what the sun would, because I was always the mirror. You know, it was fiercely competitive and it was not for the faint-hearted. And you just had to, it was a bit like being on a Ferris wheel. You just couldn't get off. And that's why I look at people like Perez or TMZ and all of these people. It's exhausting. How on earth, you know, can they do what they do each and every day and go to bed at night? Because I just couldn't. And that's why I had to get out.
Yeah, you left. And you seem really well for it. And I'm really glad you left such a long time ago because I think you missed some of the most dangerous shit that went down in this industry. What do you most want people to know? People out there who are reading these stories, seeing the ways that, in particular, mostly women, but also some men are, you know, seeing what they're subjected to. What do you most want the takeaway to be?
I feel like there's got to be a number of conversations. And I feel like, firstly, with regards to the way that social media is working and the machine of the opinions and the continual baiting online from the showbiz journalists and the showbiz titles, there's got to be some sort of group together. There almost needs to be some sort of, I don't know, licensing where the paparazzi, they can't be on the streets running after people. The journalists, it's got to be more controlled on the way that they're writing about people. Mm-hmm. It's really hard because it's so addictive the way that the showbiz machine works right now. I can say all I want about this. I'm the first that wakes up and goes on the sidebar of shame and scrolls down to see what happened last night.
Yeah.
You know, then there's responsibility and accountability that's got to come from Instagram. You know, there are certain new social media platforms that are trying to launch right now that won't allow likes and won't allow comments. But that's going to take out the fun for all of us that want to see the spiky comments or, you know, the people that will go on and they will look at the comments. I don't understand why the Daily Mail needs to have comments. They are so vile and they're so damaging, especially from clients that I've had. I don't want them to look at it, but they will. And there's no real reason why they need to be there. You know,
yeah, they do that deliberately. Like the Daily Mail in particular, I think are quite insidious and that obviously I can't claim this as fact, but it appears that what they'll do is they will hyperbolize how excellent someone is or how they look or how talented they are. They'll go on and on and on about how stunning they look, but they will use deliberately unflattering photographs where they've kind of like eyes half open, they're not ready for the picture, their mouth is open, they're sort of like, you know, bending over and exposing themselves maybe, but they'll write about them in such an effusive and hyper flattering way in order to deliberately then egg on rageful comments that are just like, she's not that beautiful or he's not that talented or this, that and the other. Do you know what I mean? They will use contradictory photographs with contradictory language in order to egg on the mean comments, and the mean comments, the chance to expel the venom of your own inner life. And I say this as a reformed troll, you know, I hold my hands up and say that I was a miserable little fuck who used to take my own misery out on the rich and the famous, you know, on people who just didn't seem real to me, people who were just strangers that I could cast judgment over, because really I was just judging myself so much that it was nice to have a break and judge someone else who I felt like it wouldn't harm. That is the mentality of a troll. And they know that that fodder of riling them up and saying that someone's so amazing will bring out the rage and the bitterness, and it will, and the comment section is where they're getting their engagement from. Their engagement is how they justify their advertising dollars. So every time you comment on an article like that, you are giving them proof of concept. You are giving them proof to an advertising company, whatever fucking like bullshit weight loss company or this, that, and the other is advertising on their pages. That company is going to give them more money because they're getting more engagement, like comments and likes. So you're funding hate every time you participate in any way. When you share it, when you comment on it, even if you're commenting on it in an angry way, screenshot it and then comment on it in an angry way. Take away their money.
100%. Another thing that I think really needs to change is I feel there needs to be education to the actual celebs, because I feel that that is something that's very undernourished.
Yes.
And I feel like there's not enough preparation for what happens to people. You know, all of these shows, I'm not going to mention the channel, but there's one channel in particular that are plucking kids from obscurity and they're chucking them into this machine. And it's very, very apparent that they cannot cope with it. So why the hell are you not starting to give them some form of education on how to deal with it? And it's not just the press. That's part of it, but the social media side of it and how to deal with the comments and how to deal with the judgment, the furious judgment and the rejection. You know, in the old days, people that were in Hollywood that were working for studios would have got training, and it was a career, it was a job, it was a school. You were going and you were having classes and you had chaperones and you had people looking after you. Then start looking after these youngsters that are coming into this machine. Unfortunately, it's not like when Big Brother started. This is getting serious. You know, people are starting to lose their lives.
Yeah.
So start to inform and educate.
100%. And, you know, not to sound too much like my character in The Good Place, Tahani, but I am friends with a lot of the most famous people in the world, some of them. And I see that all those comments that you think they're not reading, they're fucking
everyone
reading them. They're reading all of these comments, and they are unable to get out of bed some days. They are unable to get out of the house, just like you, wherever you are, if you're at school, if you work in an office, if you work in a bank, just like those comments would hurt you, it hurts them. They are seeing it. You're not just doing it for clout and then other people are enjoying the witty, like, hot take you had about that person. Like, these are some of the most powerful people who've been in this business for 20 years, who should be, you know, quote unquote, used to it by now. They are unable to move or breathe sometimes from the vitriol of online. So take ownership about what you participate in, because it goes so far beyond just a joke online. It's out there, it's public. And it's kind of forever, because once someone's seen it, even if you delete it later, it's out there forever. And I have to live with my own, you know, previous decisions 10 years ago, whatever shit that I said about, you know, famous people in the public eye. And so do you when you're out there. Anything that we did to contribute to it, we're part of the system. And we can, and what's enlightening about that, and what I think Dean and I want you to know, is that we made it, we can break it.
Yeah.
And I feel like 100%. You and I both want to be a part of breaking it.
Yeah, completely. And I think it's a conversation and it needs to be started. And there's enough people that agree on this side. It's just working out the next side. It's the general public.
Yeah, defund it. Defund it. They will follow suit. We have all the power. We control the market. We control the publications. We decide who gets to be powerful and famous and which company gets to be powerful and successful. We can take it all away, literally at the click of a button. And so what's next for you, Dean?
Well, I'm doing a bit of writing and I'm working on a few things. I think there's a conversation to be had. Well, I think there's a TV show to be had talking about the industry and the glory days. There's loads of these shows that are coming through, and I've got my PR company and I've got some nice clients. And do you know what? I just want to get up every morning with a smile on my face. And that is kind of when you're over 40. That's what you start thinking about.
Yeah. So Dean, thank you so much for coming to talk to me today. Before you go, will you just tell me, what do you weigh?
I weigh to start a conversation about what news we decide to process. What choice do we make with what we put inside our brain? Because I feel like that is where we're at with regards to media, in regards to celebrity journalism, and with regards to how we treat normal people. It's time to humanize people. And that is what I weigh.
Thank you for giving us an insight into how it worked and what it was like and how you felt about it and how I think a lot of people now are coming out of it and waking up and realizing that they were part of something so damaging and gross, something that damaged so many more people than the ones we wrote about. I really want all of us who are listening today to stop and think about how this has impacted the way that we not only look at public figures, but we look at ourselves. You know, when it comes to your body image, what's this done to you when you see someone fat shamed on a cover of a magazine? What did that do to the way that you then look at yourself if you were the same size as that person or bigger? Like, how has it impacted the way that you look at other people? How has it looked at the, how has it impacted the way that you look at, that you treat other people? Has watching adults or like other human beings dehumanize people on social media? And I don't just mean the media. I mean, you know, people on social media as well. Has that dehumanized you in any way? Has that made you feel like it's easier to say unkind and cruel things about other people that you don't even know, or people that you do know even? Just think about these things, because we've all been polluted and corrupted by this culture. And what's reassuring is that this culture is fairly modern. And so it came and it can go. And we just have to be a part, all of us, from now, of pushing it out before we lose another young person to this really toxic society. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. I Weigh with Jameela Jamil is produced and researched by myself, Jameela Jamil, Erin Finnegan, and Kimmy Gregory. It is edited by Andrew Carson, and the beautiful music that you're hearing now is made by my boyfriend, James Blake. If you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show. It's a great way to show your support. I really appreciate it, and it amps me up to bring on better and better guests. Lastly, at I Weigh, we would love to hear from you and share what you weigh at the end of this podcast. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-818-660-5543 or email us what you weigh at iweighpodcast@gmail.com. It's not in pounds and kilos, so please don't send that. It's all about your just, you know, you've been on the Instagram anyway. And now we would love to pass the mic to one of our listeners.
I Weigh having a loving and supporting family. I Weigh being a psychotherapist and a professional dancer. I Weigh being grateful always. And I Weigh being kind and loving to others.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.